Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of August. A study by the Pew Research caught our attention last week. Wealth gaps rise to record highs between whites, blacks, and Hispanics. Just to cite you some of these statistics, the net worth of Hispanic households decreased from $18,359 to $6,325 in 2009. That percentage drop was 66%. Among black households, the net worth of black households fell from $12,124 in 2005 to $5,677 in 2009, which is a decline of 53%. And in terms of white households, the drop in the wealth of white households was modest in comparison, falling 16% from $134,992 to $113,149 in 2009. These are really remarkable statistics, and we're going to analyze them and find out what they actually mean in terms of actual households this hour of the program. We have two guests with us. Joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studios is Reverend Willie Briscoe. He is president of the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. MICAH is what it is known as. He's also assistant pastor of New Covenant Baptist Church. Reverend Briscoe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Eric Vaughn. Eric Vaughn is a host of the Morning Magazine on 1290 AM WMCS. I do listen to him in the morning, and Eric and I did a series together on racial issues in this very segregated community some 9 years ago. I was talking to somebody about it over the weekend, and they said, maybe you should run that again, because I don't think much has changed in 9 years. Eric does a great show, and it's a pleasure to have you on. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Kathleen. It's so good to be back with you, and I agree. I thought about Through One City's Eyes recently. I was with Chip Duncan, and I thought we need to have those conversations again and again and again, especially after the incident at State Fair last week. We just need to be reminded that there are racial divisions, but there are people working to improve relations.
All right, I'm with you. Let's do more conversations. Thank you, Eric, so much for being with us, and I do love your show. I'm sorry we're on at the same time.
We share the same sentiment.
Yeah, I know we do. I was absolutely knocked out, and maybe both of you, or maybe I've been too in tune with other kinds of issues, but these statistics of the amount of wealth and the disparity are absolutely mind-boggling, aren't they, Reverend Briscoe?
It's unbelievable in this day and age, but there is an explanation. We kind of sit on our laurels years ago when manufacturing disappeared. We did not come up with a concerted effort to replace those jobs or to even get training for those individuals. So you saw a middle-class community go down to a poor community in a matter of 10 years.
Yeah. And was it the loss, would you agree, Eric, was the loss of manufacturing jobs and we don't have anything to replace it?
It is. And I think that there are opportunities in the city for there to be greater economic wealth growth in the minority communities, both the black community, the Hispanic community, even in the Laotian and Hmong communities. But I think that there's an infrastructure that prohibits the growth of those communities, and it's and partly the infrastructure's fault, is partly the fault of people who have prepared themselves to join the workforce. But if you really look at the study isn't talking about wealth as a new commodity earned by the generations that are, you know, celebrating it now. It's really wealth that has been developed over the years. And in many cases, the younger generations are just the beneficiaries of much of the growth and development that occurred in this community when those institutions that we've talked about and the manufacturing businesses that were once profitable in this city were thriving.
What could you see in terms of changes, Reverend Briscoe, that would bring up that net wealth of particularly minority households in this community? What would do it?
Wow, that's the 600-pound gorilla in the room. It's a complex issue with complex problems and solutions. We have to, first of all, instill hope in the people who feel that they've been disenfranchised. They feel that they have no way out, that there's nothing that they can do to improve their lot. I speak to people about the elections right now, and they say, why vote? It's not going to change anything. That's hopelessness, and that's something that permeates our community. We have to, first of all, we have to get this community reestablishing its values, that households, that individuals do count, that the lowest of our community can be provided for. And that's with both Republican and Democratic parties. We have to come together and actually reemphasize what this community values are. It was family. It was hard work. It was neighborhoods. Now all of that has changed. How do you replace the financial infrastructure? You have to start from neighborhood communities having their own businesses, having their own economy, and expanding that outward. We are trying to do this trickle down now, that the money never really reaches the bottom. Once you had reestablished the common communities, those prideful places that we once had, where you had grocery stores, you had clothing stores, you had repair entities within your own community, those things are not the whole panacea, but they are a start. Neighborhood pride, pride in neighborhood schools, pride in the churches in the neighborhood. We have to start building communities from the inside out.
And who's going to do that, Eric? It's, we look at this persistently high, sinfully high unemployment rate among minorities in this city of Milwaukee, and nothing seems to change. Year after year, we say, isn't this terrible? And those very businesses that Reverend Briscoe talked about just don't exist because they need, what do they need? Seed money? What needs to happen?
Well, I think part of what I hear Reverend Briscoe saying is that the responsibility to develop and to maintain those businesses lies with the black community itself. But this community can't do that without the support of others outside of the black community. I mean, if you look at the surrounding suburbs, the businesses that thrive and do well there are not just supported by the few people who live in the neighborhoods where those businesses exist. They're supported by a wide variety of people from communities all around. That doesn't happen. We don't see that happen with businesses in the inner city of Milwaukee. And in terms of unemployment, if those businesses that are in the city don't have the capacity, are not doing enough business to pay for the salaries of a staff that's mm-hmm. sufficient to provide the kinds of services that people need, people stop going there. It's a very, as Reverend Briscoe said, it's a very complex issue, and trying to come up with an answer to it has been the task of many, many people in various positions. But I said recently at a meeting I had with the mayor that it's really up to him, I think, to begin to push the wheel in the direction that's going to change the conditions in this city. And without the absolute intolerance for things to continue the way they are, exhibited by the mayor, I think we're going to continue to see things go in the direction
Ramadan.
They have. If I could take one
so
second and give it as an example. Same example I gave to the mayor, same thing I preach on my show day in, day out. I look at Atlanta, and I look at the period when they were rebuilding Atlanta's Hartsfield Airport, and it was mandated by Maynard Jackson, the mayor at the time, who said, if it's not about black businesses, we're not going to do it. If black people in this community, who at that time were beginning to make up the majority of the people in the inner city of Atlanta, the majority of the people in the surrounding suburbs of Atlanta, if we're not going to do something that benefits them, we're not going to do it. If this airport is not going to provide contracting opportunities and job opportunities, then we're not going to build this airport. And so then the larger community says, look, we want an airport. We're all going to benefit from that. They got on board. And that's what we have to have. That's the kind of leadership we have to have in Milwaukee. And short of that, I think we're going to continue to see the kind of deprivation and desolation that we've seen in the city for the last 10, 12 years.
Mm-hmm. We see two cities in some ways, don't we? Because there is a city, we're talking from downtown Milwaukee, and you see fancy condos going up all over the surrounding environment here. You see some people who have moved back in the city who are doing just fine, thank you. And you go about five blocks from here, and you can see suffering.
And well, many of those people that you see living in those condos you talk about don't work in the city, or if they do, they're the fortunate ones who work for the corporations that are doing well. They work in city government, they work in local government, but many of them are retirees or people who work in the suburbs, and they've chosen to live in the city because of things, you know, the amenities of the city, the entertainment value of the city, putting them in closer proximity to those things. They don't have to travel as far, and they don't have the responsibility of yard work and those kinds of things that they were getting away from in the suburban environment. But for people who live in the city, who have lived in the city, and who are still trying to find a way, the struggle is there.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Briscoe.
And Eric, I'd like to, if we were in church, I would amen what you had just said.
Amen, Reverend Briscoe.
We can't do this alone. We have to have a bold government. We are so accustomed to being comfortable with, well, we met the standards. We met the minimum goals. We want a government and a mayor's office that's going to go beyond that, that's going to say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. We have somewhat in this community given our politicians a pass because they come to our events, they shake hands, they kiss babies, and they go back to their offices, and things never change. We talk about the Republican Party, but we got to talk about the Democratic Party also. They've sit on their laurels and allowed a lot of this to happen. And now we're in a fight between the two of them, and we're caught in the crosshairs. This has to be a government that says the normal cannot exist because the normal is keeping us in this same state that we've been in for years. If we stay normal, what we are right now, with the same rate of employment, with the same rate of education, with the same rate of community deterioration, we'll be in this same state 100 years from now. We must realize that we have never truly integrated. And we must emphasize that this American dream that they sell, that democracy and capitalism go hand in hand, they do not. We must realize that we have to do something, something bold, something outside of the box, and we must not settle for anything less.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of these numbers here for a moment and what they mean in terms of households. The net worth of Hispanic households is $6,325. Of Black households, it's $5,677. Of white households, it's $78,000. And those numbers are down for all groups. But what does this mean, the net worth? What are those figures shouting out to you, Eric?
What it says to me is that the poverty of the Black community, and I mean that nationwide, and is longstanding and it's generational. Yes, we can point to some people in our race who have done extremely well. And oftentimes, when you're talking with people who are trying to make an argument that everything's all right in the Black community, don't you see this person or that person? They point to the same luminaries, the same figures who have done well. When, you know, 97-98% of the Black community is living, you know, just on the edge and on the margin. I think what that study is talking about is, again, generational wealth. It's what, you know, my grandfather had to leave to my father, you know, had left available to leave to my father, and what my father had left available to leave to me. And it's incomparable. It's incomparable to what my white friend's grandfather may have left to his father and his father left to him. And you know, we can point to a number of factors as to why that may have been the case, but I think the most glaring indicator is inequity. But we never want to talk about that. You and I joked earlier somewhat about the feature we worked on together 10 years ago, Through One City's Eyes. It talked about race in Milwaukee and racial disparity in Milwaukee over the, you know, years from 60 to 1990, those years meant something. The years that Black people were deprived of opportunities to even out the races, and I'm talking about foot races to get to success and accomplishment, are still being felt today. They're reverberating today. So when my grandson looks to, start a family and hopes that there's some, trust that he can get from me, it'll be far less than what my white counterpart, who may do the same job that I do, who might, you know, be as committed, or I might be as committed to whatever issues as they might be in the line of work that we do, but the rewards are different. And those rewards are not there to pass on to black families in the same way that they are white families.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Reverend Briscoe, you want to amplify?
I'd like to put an example. Everybody now is talking about the State Fair incident and the 4th of July incident.
Right.
And we all condemn that behavior. That's lawbreakers have to be dealt with as lawbreakers, and they have to be punished, and they have to be held accountable. Our standards in the black community is just as high as the standards in any other community. But we have to learn how to respond and not react all the time. Though that happens when the have-nots and the have clash in a setting that the have-nots have not been in often. There's many of our kids who've never been to State Fair, who never go to Miller Park. And they don't understand the disparity, but they feel it because they have lived through it through generation to through generation. And some of them think that they deserve to be where they are, or that they're being held down where they are. When we respond, we have to look at those and say, why are these incidents happening? Why is this all of a sudden becoming a major issue in our community? Well, it didn't just start. It started when the separation between the haves and the have-nots got to be so huge and so great that we have a whole race of people who are saying, I can do no better than what I am doing. They're not going to let me. Now, this is, in some instances, this is false thinking. But when you live this generation and generation, when you come out of these households, it's hard to put this down and say that this is not affecting me. So we have to realize that as a community, we have got to address the baseline of some of these problems. So some of our kids do not go morph into this activity because it is beginning to show its ugly head because we've neglected it.
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about those incidents, Eric? The State Fair incident?
Well, I mean, I don't know what else can be said. certainly we know local media has had a field day with the videos from it, whatever.
Right.
And the local newspapers has, paraded out people who say they were there. What proof is it that they really were? Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But and it's unfortunate. It's clearly an unfortunate incident. But I think that, and again, as Reverend Briscoe said, as hundreds and thousands of other people have said, there's no excuse for it. There's no rationale for it. The people who did it ought to be punished and dealt with appropriately. But I think that what we're seeing in many instances is just an out-and-out frustration with life that some people are feeling right now. And I think that once we get past the shock and awe of seeing those kinds of incidents occur, we have to really start looking at what forces people into a position where they feel that that's the only expression they can give off to address whatever frustrations they have, because it's unproductive not only for us, but certainly for them. Think about the young people who are involved in this and where they're going to end up if they're caught, if they're prosecuted, and if they're punished according to the laws that we live under now. And if we know that, how unfair and unjust and inequitable the criminal justice system is when it comes to young African Americans versus all others, it's not a great day for them. But again, until we start dealing with those things that drive them, their parents, and others in this community to react violently, to react irrationally to things that frustrate them, we're going to be in a terrible state.
Yeah. You got to have a job, right? I mean, you got to have work. It's so much a big part of all of our existences. It teaches you, how to take care of other people, and you got a sense of self-esteem, and you got some money coming in, and you hope that it's steady money that's coming in. Otherwise, your life is a bit chaotic, isn't it, Reverend Briscoe? It's just so important.
Job is important, but most of all, what's more important than everything is this is everybody's problem. This is not just an inner city problem. It's a problem of the suburbs. It's a problem of this city. It's a problem of this state. we have the greatest opportunity that we've had in history now with some of the things that's happened in government that has bound us together as a class of people. We've gone across racial lines, denominational lines, and we have realized that we all have a shared interest in the values of this community. We have what happened in Madison, those 150,000 people that one Saturday, gave me a sense of pride that I hadn't really seen before because of how many people were there but on the same issue. Just like they are energizing that issue, we must all be energizing the issue, because if the least of our population, of our humanity, is suffering, we must feel that we are suffering also. So I think one of the first issues is that we have to attack this as a people, not as a race of people, not as a community of people, but as a people. Both Black, white, Hispanic, Hmong, Native American, we all have a shared interest that makes sure that we all succeed and have our opportunities. Because if one fails, eventually it will bring down all. So if we can get past this and realize that we still have a humane responsibility, a moral responsibility to make sure that this city changes, make sure that these issues are addressed. And I think that is how we're going to have to approach it, because things like happen at State Fair, they can start to divide you. They can start to make you say that, well, this is what this happened before it cost, or this race of people, or this. It's not about a race of people. It's about a humane society of people that have to address these issues.
We go to phone calls, and we have a full bank of lines going, so we'll take you in just a moment. Keep the number in mind. If you would like to get through, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're looking at a report from the Pew Research Center released just a couple weeks ago that looked at what has happened to income disparity among Blacks, Hispanics, and whites. It is the largest since the government started keeping track of the numbers 25 years ago. And, of course, the question is, what are the ramifications of that kind of disparity? We have two guests with us, and we're welcoming calls and emails, too. You can send an email at talk@WPR.org, or our on-air phone number is 800-486-8655. Reverend Willie Briscoe is president of the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. Micah, an assistant pastor of New Covenant Baptist Church. Eric Vaughn is host of The Morning Magazine on 1290 AM WMCS here in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Christian Parenti will be joining us talking about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Let's go to phone calls for both our guests, starting our calls with Orville in Madison. Hi, Orville.
Hi. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Reverend Briscoe, Mr. Vaughn. The Pew Hispanic Center, the Pew Center usually compares American groups, dividing them into Native Americans, whites, Afro-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. And this discussion seems to be only about Blacks and whites. There's no talk about how the Asian Americans are doing or how the Native Americans are doing. That's one comment I want to make.
All right, let me just add to this. I don't see any statistics on Native Americans. Maybe the population is small and they didn't look at those. In terms of Asian, the median Asian household wealth was greater than the median for white household wealth. But by 2009, Asians lost their place at the top of the wealth hierarchy. Their net worth fell from $168,000 to $78,000. So that's the Asian statistic.
Yeah, but this is also a minority group. And
yes.
Minority groups need to look at what the Asians are doing right, just as Americans need to look at what Germany is doing right. Our economy is in shambles. And we don't understand why. It's because we're not making things and we're not selling things. We need to look at what Germany is doing if we want to bring the jobs back. The thing I also want to talk about is, we talk about government has to do this and government should do that. There's a thing called structural inequality, and government can't do very much about that. And the last thing I want to say is that the secret to success is education. Okay, we have minority populations of 50%, children born out of wedlock, 75% children born out of wedlock. I'm from a poor family. I'm a black person. The type of behavior that went on at the state fair, I could not engage in that when my parents were alive. They would kill me, okay? And that's the bottom line. The reason why the Asians are doing very well is parental control and the value of education. There are millions of people across the world, poor people, would like to get just their toe on American soil to get the chance to get an education.
Thanks, Orville, for your call. Eric, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that Orville said, and I was a little leery about bringing up the state fair thing because I imagine that people will in some way kind of twist this all into the other. I agree that there are these structural deficiencies, or there's this infrastructure, which I mentioned when we first started, that I think keeps many of the folks who would like to ascend where they are, or beneath where they want to be, at least. I don't disagree with that at all, and I don't say that it's all up to government, but as they often say, government can create the climate, can set the tone for local businesses to begin to live by new policies that are more inclusive, that provide opportunities, that, you know, just creating partnerships on some of these government projects. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. We had this huge debate on the show one day about where people ought to go and how people ought to not depend on government. Well, government spends billions of dollars, and that's every level of government, spends billions of dollars collectively on projects that benefit everybody. And everybody should benefit as part of the contractors, groups that are working on these projects. But we know the difficulties that minority contractors have trying to get in the door. We know that the criteria that's been set, the obstacles that have been placed, only serve to keep certain groups of people out, or at least to lessen their opportunity to participate in those contracting opportunities. So I don't think that government should provide jobs and provide contracts for everybody just as if there should be no qualifications met. But I think, again, that government can set the climate that at least encourages those businesses that are part of this infrastructure I talked about earlier to do better by those businesses, so that we begin to see a lessening of the wealth gap.
Reverend Briscoe.
And I agree with the caller that Micah has reached out to the Hispanic, to the Hmong, the Asian American community, and the Native American community. Some of those contacts are kind of tedious, but we are doing that. Government should not provide every need for the human beings of this planet, but they do have a responsibility to make sure that whatever the provisions are, that they're equally distributed and that they're equally accessible. The morals and the values of the community, I agree with that also. Those have deteriorated. We are trying to build up hope in the community that has felt hopeless. I agree with that. My parents also would not have condemned those actions if I had been involved. But there are some people who come out of areas, out of households, that these behaviors are in these households, that are generational in these households, and they don't have the same structure that we had. We can't condemn those individuals. We have to find a way to reach them, because if we don't, this is only going to permeate. We all in this country, as citizens of this country, deserve the same and equal rights as each citizen. And if there's a group in this country that is not what you might say benefiting or being allowed to benefit from those, then it is the right, the job of government to make sure that these resources are distributed equally.
Here's an email that's come in from Jake from Madison. My comment is that on the state and federal level, tax structures damaging the wealth-earning capacity of the middle class. The wealthy receive an absurd portion of tax write-offs. Meanwhile, the middle class is left to bear more and more of the burden of government as austerity cuts away on the government programs which allow the middle class to exist. These factors create the fragility for especially the minority middle class, which leads to the massive loss of minority wealth as seen in 2008 through today. Encouraging a vibrant middle class by evening out taxation so the wealthy begin to pay their fair share relative to the benefits they receive from our society would do a whole lot to help minorities. Eric.
Well, I think that the text writer is right on. I think one of the things that the Pew report clearly indicates is that where African Americans in more recent years have lost in the wealth race was during the housing crisis, when many African Americans went into foreclosure, or African American homes went into foreclosure, and for most people, black, white, or otherwise, the greatest investment and what you hope will give you the greatest return on your investment is the house you live in or the property you own. That's where much of our wealth was lost. So for whatever gains were made there were people who lost family homes that had been around for, decades during this most recent housing crunch. There, for whatever gains we made for years and years and years, we lost many, many, many of those gains in from 2009 until today.
Yeah, it is true that most of our wealth comes from the houses we own, and if you lose the ton, and people just lost all of that, didn't they? All of that huge investment. Yeah. Let's go. What about tax policy? Let me follow up on that for a moment. We talked about that some last hour and tried to weave it into a national discussion. Is there some link here between what our tax policy is right now and our reluctance to take on taxing people who have a whole lot? Does that play into in any way people who don't have a whole lot and they tend to be minorities? Is there a connection, Reverend Briscoe?
There's a definite connection. This company, this country, have somehow attributed this trickle down theory. If we give tax breaks to the very rich and to the big corporations, then in turn they will create more jobs and more businesses. This is how they got rich in the first place, by hoarding and getting more resources than they were destined to have. So what they're going to do, and we see it with the banks right now, when they got their bailouts, they sit on the money, because they are used to accumulating wealth and not sharing it. That is last caller was right on about how they have put this burden on the poor and the middle class to make up for their lack of taxing the upper class. That is also, I would like to say, is one of the greatest benefits to us right now, because it has put a whole group of people into the conversation that a stroke of the pen can put us all in one state. And I think now that this country has the ability and has the need to rise up and make sure that this doesn't happen again. So that's my hope.
Our next caller is Randy. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. I had the opportunity to do business from about Cesar Chavez down there to the lakefront over many years, and in the similar situations all over the United States. I had to learn the ways of that kind of area. What I found is, I wonder if you gentlemen would agree with me, what I found is that in Milwaukee, uniquely to say different from Chicago or the Twin Cities or even, say, Boston or something, if you had two or three Hispanic men or two or three young black men, even if they had just been on the street corner somewhere, those young men might be also taking classes at the community college. They're a different group of people in Milwaukee. You've got more potential. And what I found is then you could put them in the car and say, well, here, I'll take you for a sandwich, and they'll go across town to a deli and get talking about, grandma this and grandma that. They've got families. They're anchored. And so that's not the case in other communities. You folks have done a better job of anchoring your community there, and you've got more potential. Now, this is from an outsider looking in.
All right, let's get a response. Eric.
I'm an outsider too, and I'm a traveled outsider in that I'm from Washington D.C. I've lived in Arizona. I've traveled to many, many other cities around the country, and I think it's dangerous when we start trying to assign certain habits and traits to communities. I think that if you go anywhere in this country, you're going to find black people who live a certain way, and, you know, that's either good or bad, or you know, and the same thing with whites. I think that there are people who would fit whatever mold you're looking for in every community, and, you know, again, the traits are going to be the same no matter where we are. I think the key thing was something I heard this weekend at a dinner I was attending. Judge Derek Mosley was speaking, and he talked about, he put some numbers on this whole gut thing that we have about who commits crimes. And the bottom line was, he said, about 4% of our community is bad. That's 4% out of 100. That leaves 96% of the community, pretty good people who are trying to do the right thing. But 4% is a very small number compared to the whole. And those, we spend more time kind of focusing on the people who are not contributing or who are taking away from our society than we do the people who are doing the right thing. I don't think it's unique to find young people like the gentleman spoke of who are looking to do the right thing, who are doing the right thing, who are looking for opportunities. That's not odd. That's not strange. And that's universal. I don't think that's you're going to find anything any different in Madison than you'd find in Milwaukee.
You know, I think that one of the things that's different about Milwaukee is that this town continues to be incredibly segregated. You go to 60th Street and West, and you go into Wauwatosa, and all of a sudden it's primarily a white community. The boundaries are very, very stark. We have an email on this from Kristen who wants to know, and I want to know how this plays into what we're talking about, if segregation plays into this whole wealth disparity issue, and what is the difference between Milwaukee and other similar-sized cities. Reverend Briscoe?
I am a transplant also to Milwaukee. I left Mississippi in the early 60s. I spent a year in Detroit. Mississippi, I lived in a small town called Sardis. It was mostly poor black families, all were either sharecroppers or field hands or either worked in homes. But this community had values and had a tightness that you wouldn't believe. And that segregated part of the country, I probably had the best childhood that any child had because of how we looked out for each other. Now, when I went to Detroit in 65, I could not believe how black people lived. They were working at the GM factories. They had middle-class homes. They had the cars. The kids were in school. That just blew me away. And then we moved here to Milwaukee, and I lived on 16th and McKinley, and it was the same thing. Everybody was working family. All the dads were working. Everybody had jobs. This disparity just happened overnight, and it took away the values and the morals of this community. What I see now is that we all now must realize that there is no magic bullet. This is going to take some effort from this community because we've segregated. There's never been the equal but separate that they stated it would be. Our schools have always suffered greater than the schools on the outlying areas. Our businesses have always been less patronized than the businesses on the outlying area. That's because we've never truly integrated, as people said. Integration is when two things come together to make a better whole. We have been forcibly segregated, and we have been integrated on paper. But as you can travel down these communities, you can see that resources are better spent on the outlying areas. And until that becomes equal in the inner city as it is or not, you're not going to have that integration that we look for. Because there should be people who want to move into the inner city just as though they want to move into the outlying areas because of the resources and the culture and the values there. We have not added enough to the values of our inner cities, to the infrastructure of our inner cities, to make that attractive. We now are building downtown on the lakefront and on the riverfront where none of the people from the inner city have access to. That just further separates us in our minds and our goals from we can never be like that. We can never get down there. We now have a trolley system downtown that most black people are going to have to get off the bus to get on the trolley if they're going to ride it. And we are being sold that is going to help our community. Well, it's going to the rich part of our community first. So it's steadily separating in a disparity that is going to be with us forever unless we do something drastic to change it.
Eric.
Yes. On the point you make about, or the question you raise about the wealth and how it impacts the wealth, I think that I think one of the things we have here is this designation of communities, which for some people it's a wonderful thing. It's nice to say I live in such and such part of town. For others, I think it's a clear sign that there is this disparity, that there is this high degree of segregation. And I think it does affect things like housing prices. You know, the same house on the north side, on the vaunted northwest side of Milwaukee, might be, you know, thousands of dollars more simply because of its location, and not in a good sense, than a house similarly situated on the south, on the south side, or on the near west side. I think that those kinds of differences are what keeps Milwaukee divided. I think that it's also what impacts the ability of people to buy homes reasonably priced in this community. I mean, right now, if you went to buy a house in Milwaukee, the disparity in housing prices is so great, and much of it is because of where the house is. And that's the case, I guess, wherever you buy real estate, location, 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 as they say. But again, if we're talking about houses that are, you know, have the same accoutrements from one neighborhood to the next, why should there be that much of a difference in the price? And it's primarily because of the activity or the inactivity that occurs around certain homes and in certain neighborhoods versus others. Coming here 20 years ago, I had never really been exposed to the kind of racial segregation that Milwaukee has, although in Washington, or although Washington, D.C. was one of the last cities in this country to segregate or to integrate. We didn't really base neighborhoods, or it wasn't so recognizable. It may have been the case, but it wasn't so pronounced in Washington that, you know, the poor people live here, the
right.
more wealthy
right.
people live here, black people live here, Hispanics live here. Everybody kind of lived together, and, you know, while one household may not have been doing as well as the other, it wasn't a matter of kind of putting all of those households that were doing poorly in one little section of town versus all others.
We go back to phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. And we will take those in just one moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, of course, the recall elections in the state of Wisconsin. And tomorrow night at 8, we invite you to join us for special election night coverage. WPR's state government reporter Sean Johnson and Wisconsin Public Television reporter Adam Schrager will be talking with analysts and reporters and winners and losers around the state about the results of tomorrow's recall elections. That's tomorrow night at 8. We do that service well because we're a statewide network and we have good reporters, so I urge you to listen. All right, let's go back to phone calls for our guest, Adam in Milwaukee. Hello.
good morning. My interest always tends to go back to the economic area. I think it was the Reverend Driscoll that talked about how so many black people have had their houses taken away from them, and I agree with that. That's the major form of wealth that black people have, according to recent surveys. But what I don't understand is because so many of these big banks, you know, Citibank, Bank of America, Wachovia, et cetera, you know, were run by out-and-out crooks, fraudsters of every kind. I don't understand why Eric Holder, the Attorney General, doesn't have about 20,000 FBI agents, you know, who are mostly trained as lawyers and accountants anyway, going after these people with civil, maybe even criminal lawsuits. Think of the billions, maybe the hundreds of billions of dollars that were stolen that could actually be recovered.
Reverend Briscoe.
I agree with you there. The current administration has its hands so tied with trying to right this ship that it is kind of hard for them to actually concentrate on the things that put the ship in just really in the first place. I agree with you. The banks and these lending practices of Wall Street and all of these, I still believe that there will be some criminal actions coming to them when we are through with this crisis, because right now the major focus is to try to make sure that people don't sink any further. I agree with you totally that the banks have been irresponsible, the lending agencies, Wall Street, all of the above. I hope that when this is all over, that they are held accountable for where they put this country.
There was an interesting piece on 60 Minutes last night that the caller may want to go online and look at, but it was about the companies that were kind of the middle people that doesn't get to the banks, which I think is, I agree with Reverend Briscoe, that there are enough people pointing at the banks now that eventually I think some will fall as a result, or they will pay a price for what they've done. But right now they're going after the middlemen in many of these instances, and there've been some there's been some progress on this in terms of prosecuting folks who actually filled out fraudulent papers on behalf of both the homeowners and the lenders, and really exacerbated this problem of foreclosure to a point where the country is just upside down in foreclosures right now.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Brian in Madison. Hi.
How you doing?
All right. How are you, Brian?
All right.
Good.
I grew up in the 60s, and as speakers had said earlier, and everybody has agreed, not much has changed since then for, you know, Black America. And I tend to fault the Black leaders for a lot of this problem, and let me give you examples. Just like the situation at the fair. If I wonder how many jobs at that fair were held by Black individuals, where they had a proprietorship to the fair going on. There was mention of contracts and things being built in Milwaukee, whatever. How many Black organizations or agencies are getting those contracts? And we have Black leaders who have forums, who have TV shows, who have churches. We should be organizing boycotts, just like back in the 60s, and give these people with this energy that's going to come out in the negative way, as far as mini rides or up or things like that, have them have a voice in the boycott, which will kind of keep some of this stuff on a lower level.
Boycotting what? Boycotting what, Brian?
What was that now?
Boycotting what?
Boycotting different banks. If a bank is not giving Black individuals loans, boycott that bank. If the fair is not giving Black individuals jobs at the fair, boycott the fair.
Eric.
Well, you know, I agree that that's the kind of action that ought to take place, but I'll say this. Things are so bad in Milwaukee in terms of race relations, and we don't talk about it enough. You have to credit the YWCA for its efforts to try to bring people together on race. But, you know, people are so stiff-necked in this community, business people, that they probably wouldn't care if they didn't get Black people coming into their businesses. Now, there are some that thrive on the Black dollar, but many of them, and I would say State Fair is one, just by evidenced by the kind of activities they have at State Fair, which are not inclusive, they probably wouldn't care if Black people never showed up.
Reverend Briscoe.
And what the caller said, we're taking an approach. We want to get the minority contractors together, those business entities that feel that they've been disenfranchised, and build a force behind them. Then we want to take those contractors and that virtual company to these powers that be and say, now we've dotted all our I's, crossed our T's, we've come together as a unified front. This is what we want. I think once we get our business set together, our mind set together, that we can do this, because a lot of people don't want to buck the system. There are a lot of contractors that feel if I protest, I won't get any work at all. But they're not getting any work now. So that's the first thing that we need to do, is get these entities in order and on one page to realize that they need to unify to try to bring this community the resources it deserves. And then we go as a unified front to the mayor's office, to these business entities that and the banks that have left us out.
You know, things seem pretty depressing, actually, the more we talk. Can either of you look at some action that was taken, be it by government or be it by a spectacular leader, that has made things better in some way? Somebody who really did something unusual and good. Eric?
Well, no, I was waiting for Reverend Briscoe.
No.
I have an answer for you, but I was going to say, I think that what Reverend Briscoe just talked about, an effort being led by Micah, and over the years, many efforts headed by Micah have been in the right spirit. The problem is getting people on board and getting enough people to really have the kind of impact. And, as I said, trying to get these stiff-necked business owners and even some of the folks in government to understand the plight and really be committed to changing them. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that happened recently in Milwaukee was the disparity study that came out last year. that really exposed the city's ineffectiveness on minority contracting and even minority hiring. As much as the city would like to tell you they do a marvelous job of it, their own study, the study they paid $500,000 for, indicated that the city has done extremely poorly in achieving any of the goals, and you can't call them goals anymore, but achieving some sense of equity in the contracting process. But I have to commend, the aldermen in the city, Willie Hines and Ashanti Hamilton, Willie Wade, and the others, Michael Murphy, who signed on to this thing and really worked. Joe Davis, one of the original architects of the plan to create this study, they all have to be commended, because what it did was it put the city on notice that it has to do a better job.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Eric, thank you.
Thank you,
thank
Kathy.
You. And Reverend Briscoe, thank you very much. A pleasure to meet you. Thanks to both of our guests. Chrissy Pease, the producer of the hour. Thanks, Chrissy, for producing the show. And thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. The study we reference is the Pew Study, Wealth Gaps Rise to Record Highs Between Whites, Blacks, and Hispanics. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for listening. We're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.